and welcome to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Michaela Kennan here in the KRCB studios with my co-host Gary Carnevale. Our engineer Mary Moore Campagna is here on our right, and we have a very cinematic show in store for you this evening. First up, screenwriter Jeff Cotton will join us to talk about his exciting work, which includes three scripts that he's written and hopes to bring to the big screen. And we'll be starting out with author Scott O'Brien. He's just written a new book entitled Ruth Chatterton, Actress, Aviator, Author, which is about an extraordinary actress who's also enjoyed great success during the early years of American cinema. We'll welcome Scott directly after Greg Moralia and the Outbeat Radio News and Calendar right now.
I have found Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, November 17th, 2013. On Wednesday this week, Hawaii Governor Neil Abercrombie signed marriage equality into law, making the Aloha State the 16th to support same-sex couples. State Representative Bob McDermott filed a suit challenging the new law and sought a temporary restraining order to prevent the issuance of marriage licenses to same-sex couples. At the heart of McDermott's argument is a constitutional amendment passed by voters in 1998, giving the legislature the authority to reserve marriage for opposite-sex couples. Circuit Court Judge Carl Sakamoto said that the legislature does have the power to define marriage and the law signed yesterday by the governor, and it will go into effect as planned on December 2nd. And from Texas, when Jaden Laredo, a transgender student at La Feria Independent High School near the Texas Gulf Coast, wore a tuxedo for his high school yearbook photo, the school principal told him it wouldn't be included because it violated, quote, community standards. All students sit for two photos, one with casual clothing and one in formal attire. For boys, that means a tuxedo, and for girls, it's drapes of fabric or blouses. Laredo asked the photographer if it would be okay for him to wear a tux. She said she had no problem with it, but suggested he ask a teacher in charge of the yearbook. The teacher kicked the question to the principal, who said it wouldn't be allowed. The photographer offered to take the shot anyway, but when the photo proofs arrived, Laredo's formal shots were blank. The Southern Poverty Law Center, a civil rights group, on Wednesday threatened in a letter to sue the school district in federal court unless it allows Laredo's tuxedo picture in the yearbook. Laredo, 18, was born female and is now a young man. Excluding his picture violates the freedom of expression protected by the 14th Amendment, along with the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the Anti-Discrimination Law, Title IX, and the school's own anti-discrimination policies, according to the letter. And here locally, it's holiday time and food for thought. The Sonoma County AIDS Food Bank needs your help to provide Thanksgiving dinner for some 675 residents affected by HIV/AIDS in Sonoma County. Your cash donation of $20 can provide a turkey, stuffing, sweet potatoes, cranberries, and a pumpkin pie for a family of five. And if cash is tight, Food for Thought is also looking for a variety of food items you likely have in your house right now. You can learn more about how to help at fftfoodbank.org. And speaking of Food for Thought, the 12th annual Dining Out for Life is scheduled for Thursday, December 5th. Created in 1991, Dining Out for Life is a trademarked international event conducted in more than 65 cities in the United States and Canada, raising some $4 million annually for HIV-related services. 86 restaurants throughout Sonoma County will be participating. There are a variety of Michelin-rated restaurants. Some will be serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and reservations are recommended. Proceeds from the event will provide funding to support Food for Thought's mission to provide comprehensive nutrition and other services to men, women, and children affected by HIV/AIDS in the county. In 2012, Dining Out for Life raised $125,000 to provide food and other services. 5,000 loyal diners from across the North Bay participated in last year's Dining Out event, which took place at 85 restaurants with more than 120 volunteer ambassadors providing service to support the event. If you'd like to get involved or learn more about this year's Dining Out event, again, go to fftfoodbank.org. Now, here's your calendar events for the coming week. On Wednesday, November 20th at 5:30 p.m., Tate Burney, Linda Shear, CPA, and family law attorney Keena Crocker will provide a free public seminar for the LGBT community regarding tax, family law, and estate planning in the wake of last summer's two U.S. Supreme Court decisions striking down DOMA. This event will take place at the Sebastopol Regional Library, and an RSV is requested. Call 823-8593 to learn more. And on Thursday, November 21st at 7 p.m., the new Napa PFLAG group invites you to attend a holiday meet and greet at the Napa River Point Resort, 500 Lincoln Avenue in Napa. The event starts at 7 p.m. Wine, cheese, and chocolates from local merchants will be served. And you can learn more at pflagnapa.org. And finally, a save the date, December 9th at 7:30 p.m., the Kinsey Six will perform a holiday show, Oy Vey in a Manger, as a benefit for the congregation near Shalom at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park. Tickets are now available at shalomevents.com. And for more information about local LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. And if you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatnews.com. Follow us all week long on Twitter and Facebook for the latest LGBT news and information from here in the North Bay and beyond. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Outbeat Collage with Gary Carnevale and Michaela Kennan.
Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Scott O'Brien is the author of three previous film biographies, Kay Francis, I Can't Wait to Be Forgotten, Virginia Bruce, Under My Skin, and Anne Harding, Cinema's Gallant Lady. His new book, Ruth Chatterton, Actress, Aviator, Author, honors a very talented actress who was multifaceted during a time when it wasn't easy for women to be so. Welcome back to Outbeat Collage, Scott.
Thanks, Gary. And what you said is true. It was an easy path for women of Chatterton's generation. In her 1933 film called Female, she played a character very much like herself who declared, I'm going to travel the same open road that men have always traveled. And off screen, she did.
Welcome, Scott. It's nice to see you again.
Thanks.
Your book's title mentions Ruth Chatterton's three passions, the actress, the aviator, the author.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense first about her acting career that started when she was a teenager as a stage actress and then carried through the silent era. Fill us in a little bit more on that.
Well, by the time she was 16, Ruth and her she had to support her mother. They gave up on their dad. He married into money, went through it, and then declared bankruptcy, several of them. So they were staying with her Aunt Miriam in Washington, D.C., and as a lark, she went on stage. And then that got her hooked, and she did some minor theater roles in Milwaukee and in New England. And at 19, she found herself a star on Broadway in producer Henry Miller's hit The Rainbow. And this was followed by two other box office smashes, Daddy Long Legs and Come Out of the Kitchen. She made Henry Miller a rich man.
Mm-hmm.
Her success afforded Miller to build a shrine to himself, the Henry Miller Theater, which became a great New York landmark. She was also his mistress, despite 33 years difference in their ages. But by 1919, Ruth, she had matured, she was ambitious, and became an actress manager. Her passion for Miller had waned, and when she fell in love with a young British actor named Ralph Forbes, Miller stormed out of her life. Not long afterward, Forbes was called to Hollywood for Beau Geste with Ronald Colman, that's 1926. Ruth tagged along, fast forward to 1928, the great silent actor Emil Jannings cast Ruth in Sins of the Fathers at Paramount, and it wasn't long before she surpassed the It Girl, Clara Bow, at the box office and was nominated twice for an Academy Award as Best Actress. And one thing about Ruth, she wasn't a personality star like Clara Bow. She had the ability to immerse herself in a character, whether it was the desperate, drug-addicted Madame X in 1929 or the German-born immigre fighting for her child and Sarah and Son in 1930. Ruth brought grit and excellent diction to the screen, and many of his silent players couldn't measure up to that. Anyway, after 3 years at Paramount, she was Paramount's major star. Warner Brothers paid a fortune to get Ruth Chatterton under contract. And then after a couple of years at Warner Brothers, she told everybody that she was richly tired of Hollywood. And I think Hollywood felt the same about her at that point. She locked horns with her boss, Jack Warner, and she was ready to freelance at that point.
That's a lot of info. Well, what I love about all of your books is this great sense of history, both, you know, American history or the history in general, and film history, because this was such a crucial time for Hollywood. The switch from silent films to talkies, and like you mentioned, not all those actors survived that switch. A lot of them didn't really have a great voice. So talk about the amount of research that's required to achieve this, and what are some of your favorite sources? Yeah.
Well, firstly, you have to put a biography in context with the times. That it just carries the story, and you know how they got their worldview. Mm-hmm. And thank God I was able to contact a family member in San Diego, Ruth's cousin, Brenda Holman. And she sent me a sizable package filled with the only memorabilia and photos that Ruth had saved from her personal life and career. The conversations I had with Brenda, priceless stuff. Before Ruth passed away in 1961, Brenda saw a great deal of her. And she told me, Ruth was one of a kind. She was alive. She was just in there. She was very bright, and she was consumed by politics. The world around her. To me, she was an authority on everything, and she could be really funny. Comments like that are truly the life's blood of a biography. And I also had a nice long chat with Eva Marie Saint, North by Northwest, you know,
wow.
Hitchcock. Yeah, she called me, and she worked with Ruth during the 1950s, and she had nothing but, you know, raves to say about her, and that she had learned a lot from professionals. Well, I mean, Ruth's career started in 1909.
Right.
So.
Her sort of elders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as far as research, aside from libraries, there are numerous online resources now. When I first did the Kay Francis book, I was always going to the library, having microfilm shipped from back east and all this kind of stuff. Well, now, I mean, there's just countless news archives, and I subscribe to a couple of them, and along with the New York Times. Ancestry.com, I subscribe to that. Mm. That gives you access to birth records, marriages, census records, travel records, all that kind of stuff. And so you can kind of pinpoint, okay, how far off is this person when they say that they were 25
right,
in a certain
right.
year when they were really 35. Ruth, she was born in on December 24th, 1892. And in the 40s, on one of her crossing a border from Canada to U.S., she said she was born in 1906. So what's that, 14 years she lopped off? It's amusing. But, you know, they were all doing it. And there's also a great resource at the Library of Congress Archive. It's available for free. This is free. Mm. And they have thousands of film journals and magazines from 1910 to 1960.
Right.
And a great search engine.
Right.
Anyone who likes old movies, go to the Library of Congress Archive. You can go through every issue of Photoplay from like 1920 to 1943.
Wow. And that was a huge market. I mean, they really wrote about stars then. I mean, we think because there was such a publicity machine, and there were so many magazines that really.
But the thing is, Gary, in a lot of those magazines, it's not publicity. Well, of course, you go to the newsstands now, and it's all, you know, scandal sheets.
Right, right.
But there was some reputable authors and writers that would go to Hollywood. They would interview stars, and they got honest, straightforward, you know, rather personal comments in some of these magazines. And I think it started to fade maybe, in the late 40s. It became more, let's be nice to the star. But in some of the interviews on those old movie magazines are quite candid. And I'm sure the studio was not pleased.
Right, right.
But anyway, it's a full-time endeavor. You really have to immerse yourself to get these books written. And as they say, leave no stone unturned.
Well, we were talking just before the show, too, where you said there's, you know, well over 1,100 footnotes to this book alone.
Right, right. And the reason I footnote and document things is because there's a lot of biographies and on cinema history that are coming out with make-believe stuff, make-believe conversations, and I just want to pinpoint where I got the quotes that I researched.
You offer some real detailed accounts of what Hollywood was like during the early years, and as well as some criticisms of Ruth's films. Were you able to watch all of her film, and do you have some favorites, and why?
Yeah, well, altogether, she made only 26 films, and I was able to locate 20 of them. There was three silent ones that are unavailable. And then the last film she did in Britain, A Royal Divorce, as far as I know, it's a lost film. But I really tracked them down. A lot of Paramount, for some reason, Turner Classic Movies doesn't have access to those early Paramount films. Hmm. And so you have to get them from private collectors. But 1936's Dodsworth, which was directed by William Wyler, a Sam Goldwyn picture, it received 7 Academy Award nominations, and it's an easy favorite. Laura Linney, the actress, she's been nominated twice for Best Actress herself. She lists Dodsworth as her personal favorite film. And as she put it, she said, Ruth Chatterton's deep portrayal of a very superficial person is amazing to watch. There was a lot of tension on the set. Ruth played this woman who was trying to recapture her youth. And she and her husband go to Europe, and she's very flirtatious. She calls them her little escapades, and she dyes her hair blonde and wears all these younger looking outfits and stuff. And it's a struggle to watch it, but it's fascinating to watch. And she does an amazing job with this role. Now, she did not receive an Academy Award nomination because she was freelancing. She wasn't playing the studio game. And a lot of those people who got Oscar nominations in the 30s. They were the ones who were going along with Louis B. Mayer and doing what the studio told them. Mm. The studio didn't want to honor these rebels like Ruth. Mm-hmm. Now that film Dodsworth is on DVD. Two other Chatterton favorites are also available on Turner Classic Movies' Forbidden Hollywood series: 1933's Frisco Jenny, and the aforementioned Female. Now in Frisco Jenny, which is one of Ruth's personal favorites, she plays the daughter of a San Francisco saloon owner. And when she tells her father that she and the piano player had fooled around, he slaps her to the floor. And before she has a chance to get up, the walls begin to shake. The roof collapses on top of the father. And before we know it, the 06 quake places unwed, pregnant Ruth out on the streets of San Francisco. And she hangs out for a while with the Salvation Army, but has better luck running a bordello. It's the kind of movie it's the kind of movie they quit releasing after the Catholic Legion of Decency and the production code clamped down on Hollywood in 1934. Anyway, those are three favorites.
You're such a great writer, Scott, and you really bring Ruth to life. Talk a bit about the interviews that you've conducted with her relatives and people who worked with her.
Well, I spent several weeks trying to locate Ruth's family. As far as the Chatterton side, forget it. She didn't have any first cousins. Mm. And I mean, her only uncle never had any children. And then, of course, her dad abandoned her and her mother, and they or vice versa. Anyway, my luck began with a 1903 news clipping, which detailed the wedding of Ruth's Aunt Miriam. She's the one who lived in Washington, D.C. Ruth was the flower girl at the wedding. And from this lone article, I did census, news archive, and people search on Miriam's progeny, and it paid off. And I found myself talking with Miriam's grandson, who visited Ruth when he was a kid. He told me that he would have a lot more to say to me if Ruth had been Babe Ruth. He said, oh, my sister Brenda, she liked all that movie star stuff. So he gave me her phone number. And like I said, Brenda had lots of stories to tell about her famous cousin. She sent me that whole package of memorabilia. So
is it a matter of just kind of tracking these people down, calling up and saying, hi, I'm Scott, and this is what I'm doing?
Right. Well, on the Anne Harding book, I was trying to track down her companion, adopted daughter. And I sent out seven. Her name was Grace Kay, and I sent out seven letters to different Grace Kays in the Los Angeles area, and one in Las Vegas. And it turned out that I got a phone call. Well, Joel actually answered the phone. And, are you Scott O'Brien? And anyway, it turned out that it was Grace Kay. And she said, I don't want a biography written on my mother. I said, oh, was she your mother? I am her adopted daughter. And I thought, okay, this woman has a lot of character, you know. And, you know, by the end of the conversation, she opened up a little. And I don't know what all the mystery was.
Right,
it was about
right.
some mysterious letters, but that was interesting.
Some good skeletons.
You never know.
Right.
It's also interesting that she became an aviator at some point in her life. How does she become interested in flying?
Well, she said Ruth said that aviation brought her incomparable relaxation. And aside from being the best form of wanderlusting, she noticed it had reduced all sorts of vexations to inconsequential trifles. At one point, one jaunt that she took was up to San Francisco to have lunch with some friends, and she ended up in Fort Bragg. She had, she had to do a forced landing. So there was all these little – but she had very courageous. She began – her interest began in 1926, and by 1934, she had her pilot's license and decided to sponsor her own air derbies, which took place in 1935 and 1936. And they got a great deal of national news coverage. A lot of people wanted – well, Jimmy Stewart, for one, wanted to participate. But the studio really clamped down. They didn't want their stars up in the air. So Jimmy didn't get to fly. And then during World War II, the Royal Canadian Air Force ranked her as a captain in the Queen's Own, the only woman so designated. And she also had an insignia from the U.S. Air Corps. She wasn't involved in combat. She saved that for her novels.
Speaking of, she's published several books, most to critical success. Talk about her novels, their subject matter, and what made them popular with readers.
Well, her first novel, Homeward Bourne, was released in 1950. She was still acting on stage. It stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 23 weeks. It was considered a great success.
Amazing.
And the book targeted the plight of Jewish refugee orphans and their assimilation into American society and the diehard prejudices of Americans toward Jews. Her second novel, The Betrayers, took on another controversial subject. In this, she attacked the ruthless tactics of Senator Joseph McCarthy and the House of Un-American Activities, the communist witch hunts. It took courage. Like I said, she was still doing stage and some television work during the 1950s, and many fellow actors' careers were ruined by the HUAC investigations. As her cousin said, Ruth was consumed with politics. In her 1958 novel, The Southern Wild, Chatterton attacked racial prejudice and helped pave the way for civil rights. She was progressive. She was focused on action that was beneficial to everyone, not just a select few. And one interesting aspect about her novels is that they had no heroes in them. She showed all the characters' shortcomings, and I liked that. It made it more real.
So you were able to read them all?
Yes. Yeah, they're all available. I mean, if you want to read her books, I don't know about libraries, but I got them on eBay.
Well, that makes me curious. So, in addition to Ruth, you've written three other books about actresses who were successful in their time. but whose work probably is fading for the average movie fan of today. What draws you to these women in particular and somehow convinces you that you need, we need to know more about their lives?
Well, when I was in, when I started high school, or junior high, they started releasing old movies on TV. So I'd come home from school and there'd be this whole group of stars I'd never heard of. And then I'd ask my parents questions. Anyway, by the time I was 14, I was really hooked on old movies. And there was a my favorite was Myrna Loy, and who I got to meet a few times and talk to. Wonderful, wonderful lady. And I like Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy and Alice Faye. And but by the time I decided to write biography, there was already books written about those people. And on top of that, I mean, who needs another book on Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Katharine Hepburn, Marilyn Monroe, Ruth Chatterton, and Kay Francis, Ann Harding, and Virginia Bruce were just as well known during their era. And they've been overlooked but not forgotten. And they are deserving of having their story told. I like them enough to want to know more. And I got a master's in library science in college, and I love doing research. And so that's behind my motivation, for sure.
It's a really sort of lost segment of movie lore that young people really don't get to see those old films like we did. You know, the networks really don't play old films.
Well, they don't unless they subscribe to Turner Classic Movies. And I get mail from or emails from kids who were like 18, 19. I helped this one kid. I sent him a lot of stuff who wanted to do a Kay Francis website. He was 19 years old. So I thought, well, you know, even though I started in my passion over 50 years ago for classic film, here's young kids.
Right.
There's something about those old films. They have their own look and feel and charisma.
Charm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think of movies today?
I don't go that often anymore, but this last year I really enjoyed 42, the story of Jackie Robinson, and the first African-American big league player. That was really well done. I can always tell when tears well up in my eyes a few times during the movies. And there were parts of The Great Gatsby that I enjoyed. I thought the acting was really good. I was disappointed in the music. The 1920s is such a rich era for music, and they had a lot of contemporary things in there.
Do you think all the digitalization and technology and special effects,
it's overdone? But you know, people, you know,
but that's today's,
that's today,
that's today's era.
So who are you writing about next?
Well, while I was researching Ruth's second husband, actor George Brent, who, by the way, was Betty Davis's favorite co-star, they made 11 films together, an Irish filmmaker named Brian Redden contacted me for an interview. He flew from Dublin and drove from San Francisco up to KRCB studio, where his crew filmed the interview. Anyway, it was Redden who encouraged me to write about George Brent, who was a rather low-key player. And he played opposite all the actresses I've written about, along with Garbo, Ginger Rogers, Myrna Loy, 6 films with the great Barbara Stanwyck, and on and on. And it's been interesting wading through all the blarney George Brent said about himself. Very secretive guy. So that's my current project.
And you'll be revealing all those secrets.
Some of them.
Or dispelling a few myths.
Well,
or
Brian Redden, the guy from Dublin, and he's been to Ballinasloe, where in Galway, where Brent was born, and he's talked to locals. He got a copy of the birth certificate, and so between the two of us, we got through. We solved a few of the mysteries. So
great.
We can't wait. With holidays coming up, it sounds like a great stocking stuffer or something to put on your holiday list, how can we get a copy of the book?
Well, they're available online at Amazon.com or my publisher, Bear Manor. You can order it from Barnes & Noble or your local bookstore. Oh, and one thing I did want to say, Ruth had a great fan base among gay men. She would have these things called salons in the 30s and 40s, and all these young gay guys would come around and worship her at her feet, and they would talk until 3 or 4 in the morning. She was close friends with Guthrie McClintock and Catherine Cornell. They were both gay. And Noel Coward.
And Ramon Navarro.
And Ramon Navarro. Yeah, he would come to her house and sing to her. Mm. And Ivor Novello, the British, she got him started in films, his first American film role. And that was while he was writing dialogue for Tarzan and Jane for MGM.
Well, it sounds harder than it probably more difficult than it sounds.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't that thrilled with the assignment. He thought MGM was going to make him a star. Instead, he wrote, "Me Tarzan, you Jane."
Scott, it was great having
thanks.
You back on Alpi Collage.
Fun. You guys have been great.
Thanks. We wish you the best of luck with the book and hope you'll come back soon.
All righty.
All right. 2 weeks ago today, we lost one of rock's greatest artists, Lou Reed, from his time with the Velvet Underground, the house band for Andy Warhol's Factory, to his huge career as a solo artist. Told musical stories about a world most of America never had been exposed to. Lou was bisexual, never shied away from the hard truths about the lives of his transgender friends, his coming out, as well as his drug use. It's hard to believe this song was a top 10 radio hit in 1972. Here from his Transformer album is Lou Reed with Walk on the Wild Side.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, "Hey babe, take a walk on the wild side." Said, "Hey honey, take a walk on the wild side." She was everybody's darling, but she never lost her head. Even when she was given head, she says, "Hey babe, take a walk on the wild side." Said, "Hey babe, take a walk on the wild side." And the colored girls go do 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 do. Gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, "Hey babe, take a walk on the wild side." I said, "Hey Joe, take a walk on the wild side." Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the streets, looking for soul food and a place to eat. Went to the Apollo, you should have seen him go, go, go. They said, "Hey sugar, take a walk on the wild side." I said, "Hey babe, take a walk on the wild side." All right. Ha. Jackie is just speeding away. Thought she was James Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that fetch. I said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doo 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 doo.
Listening to Outbeat Collage here on KRCB-FM Windsor Santa Rosa. Support for Outbeat comes from our members and from Bay Nature, the quarterly magazine that explores the natural world of the Bay Area. The current issue features this year's celebration of the Year of the Bay with the publication of Baylands Reborn, Restoration and Renewal on San Francisco Bay, and also heads to Butano State Park. Take a close look at Poison Oak and more. More information available at baynature.org. Also comes from the new Hansel Subaru, which is now open in Santa Rosa, featuring the full line of new 2014 Subarus with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Hansel Subaru on Corby Avenue or at hanselsubaru.com. And now, back to Outbeat Collage, Out in the Arts.
Thanks, Mary, and welcome back to Outbeat Collage, Out in the Arts. I'm Michaela Kennan, here with my co-host Gary Carnevale. Jeff Cotton is our next guest. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist. He trains also with the National Foster Parent Association. He's worked with abused, abandoned, and homeless youth for over 35 years, and in addition has written three screenplays, a gritty but true-to-life trilogy about at-risk youth who find themselves in desperate situations and yet emerge as gay teen heroes. Thank you for joining us tonight, Jeff. Welcome.
Well, that was a great encapsulation since I've never met you before. You did really well.
Hey.
It's true.
It's like Russian River Night also. It's not just Cinema Night. It's Russian River
everyone's
Night.
Everyone's coming in from the boonies
yes,
there.
Yes. All right, Jeff, your three screenplays, The Reckoning of Billy Barnes, Little Dragon, and Dark, Dangerous Homecoming, are based on a novel you wrote a number of years ago. Tell us about your decision to adapt the novel for the screen.
Well, my friend Ronnie is a filmmaker, and when he started reading it, at one point the juvenile hall scene just jumped off the scale. And so we said, this is so visual. Let me show you how to turn this over. And so we did the first two pages in final draft, and I got to see how it broke down. It's like, oh, and it was a medium that I gravitated toward because the book is very visceral, very visual. It's like, there you are. Can't get away from it. And so it became a labor of love. They just became like these adaptations of what was really a very, very hardcore book. I mean, the book was really so X-rated. It was never even planned to get published. It was really my exorcism. And that was the truth. And then the screenplays came out of it, and they're much more R-rated. You know, so in some way it kind of took care of what needed to get taken care of. And, and get to kind of rip roar out.
Right. Not X-rated because it's erotica. X-rated because it's...
It's violent. It's intense.
Violent,
it's kids on the street.
Life,
it's I mean, to this day, 30% of kids are still getting kicked out of their homes. You know, 30% of the suicide rate is about the same. The suicide rate for transgendered is about the same, 50%. So, I mean, it remains very much in force. I figured at one point these things would be dated, and even with all the changes that have happened here, still, it's so intense. It's so hard being, you know, a gay kid in the USA.
Still.
Still. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of a mess.
Yeah, hard to imagine. And I think sometimes we get lost in our kind of comfortable Sonoma County bubble, thinking that we're liberal, we're well aware, we're conscious people, and everything's cool, but not so in most parts.
No, not in most parts, and not in most schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, to this day, 69% of kids still get physically bullied. 89% still hear homophobic crap about themselves to this day. Mm-hmm. So, and they mentioned one assault could be enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so right. I mean, to this day, it's just like, what is it like being a gay kid? This is a rough and tumble road. And yet, this is what healed me. You know, I look at all the crap that any of us have gone through in our lives. It's all like compost. I mean, if we work it through, if we come to the other side of it, things that broke us down, broke our hearts, broke them open, if we finally healed those become the places where the great and wise teachers on the planet. I mean, I never would have written this book had I not gone through all this crap about being a gay kid. I knew I was a gay kid. Mm-hmm. I knew early I was a gay kid. I knew it would be all over when I came out with my parents. Came out with my parents like, you know, 6 years later at 19. And it was all over for the next 30 years. Mm-hmm. It was like there was no way to mm-hmm. really meet around this issue. So mm-hmm. it's all the stuff that kind of broke me apart. And these were a labor of love. I mean, initially, I had this one paragraph in my head about this 14-year-old kid out on the highway, no home, no destination, no hope, and it was just kind of ruminating in me. And I brought it to my teacher, Kenny, who I'd been working with, and I mentioned I had this thing going about this kid in the highway, and he repeats it back. And afterwards, I said, son of a bitch, it's me. You know, because I hadn't been physically kicked out of my home. I had been emotionally kicked out of my home, and suddenly it was my story. It was emotional autobiography. The book was that. And the screenplays became that. So it just mm-hmm. became held by this deep truth, these dark, dangerous love stories.
Is that your inspiration? Is that the spark? Where does the spark come from? At what point do you say, this is something that needs to be told, or this is something that needs to get out and put mm-hmm. into a form?
Yeah. When it was me, I guess when it got so personal that Mike... That the main lead is me. He's mm-hmm. this emotionally bright kid who just gets it. And there was a place that he just got kind of shredded on his way up and then became whole, became strong, stood up, you know, mm-hmm. made his stand. And so in that, it became this absolute honor of being able to, like, witness these, you know, kids who hit the streets early and who find their way in the middle of, you know, hell, mm-hmm. you know, but do, who find their way. I mean, it's not Brokeback Mountain. It's not about two men in 1963 who cut the deal and one gets beaten to death by homophobes and one becomes asexual. They're not that. These are kids who find their way, even with their own internalized homophobia. Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. so it's exciting for me. It's, I never know how it's going to turn out. I'm in the middle of rewriting the novel of it, and it moves mm-hmm. me to this day. And mm-hmm. the screenplays, you know, in some way move me to tears, mm-hmm. and they do. They mm-hmm. they just hit someplace in me. It's just the truth. So
what
it's easy.
What
to
is the point where you go from a novel, you know, mm-hmm. book form, to saying this needs to be on stage or on film? Where does that transition happen?
That's a nice question. I'm not sure quite how to answer it in the moment. I'm not if there was ever a conscious decision of how these would get made. Well, the book I knew wouldn't be published. That was so much my own exorcism. The screenplays were, oh, no, here, let me bring this to the world in some way. Mm-hmm. We get to be the hero of the movie. You know, we're not just victims. We're not just like, you know, someone's best friend. You know, and we get to be the hero of these movies. And, these, you know, really tough kids, you know, Billy's an illiterate street kid and Mike's this sweet boy and this other boy, Miguel Cruz, he's heading for the Olympics. I mean, so these are very non-stereotype kids, the kids who I love to see, kids who don't fit the mold. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure my own coming out, it was like there were no heroes growing up. And for about 20,
like
30
gay
years,
heroes,
that was a
right.
nightmare. And then it became freeing. Mm-hmm. But it took finally about 30 years to finally, okay, well, then I'll be myself. But that took decades to finally come to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is to have these boys who become these heroes, Mike and Billy, who are these little boy heroes who've come to their integrity.
Right.
So tell us about the story behind each screenplay. You know, offer us a brief sort of synopsis of each and how they're connected.
Okay, great. So Billy Barnes, The Reckoning of Billy Barnes, was actually the second screenplay written, but it is actually the first in the series. It's about an illiterate kid, Billy Barnes, out of rural Redneck, Georgia, who hits, you know, who gets kicked out early, gets recognized early, hits the streets early, flees Georgia for San Francisco, has no clue how to be able to get by, and finally, you know, meets a hitchhiker who says, here's how you can do it if you want to do it. This is a way that you can do this. And so in that place, finally, you know, there's a place he wouldn't be on the streets. He wouldn't end up homeless in that way. I mean, he gets hotels, he gets places to live. Mm-hmm. So he knows how to do this. So in some way, he became this kid who, see, if you're illiterate, which a lot of gay kids are, you know, it's the single factor that puts people into San Quentin. I mean, into prison. What is the single factor? If you could give kids one gift in the world that would keep them out of jail and juvenile hall, it's learning how to read and write. If you can't read and write, you can't hold a job at McDonald's. You can't get a driver's license. I mean, already you are an outlaw. You are welcome to a grunt, low-paying job. Mm. So this kid, Billy, is faced with, like, he has a chance to be able to deal, and he sees these Lamborghinis and what's possible dealing, and yet he gets a job in a restaurant where these people are willing to teach him to learn how to read and maybe be a waiter. But inside, he knows he's dumb as dirt, can't possibly read, never be a waiter, end up doing grunt jobs like his father, the janitor, which sets up the reckoning of Billy Barnes, where essentially crime makes a lot of sense. Mm. You know, crime makes a lot of sense to be able to, you know, prestige and money and being looked up to in some way. So it's a profound reckoning for him to be able to choose Miguel, who he meets, this gay boy who's openly gay kid, and Billy's, you know, both illiterate and closeted, and he meets a gay kid who essentially shows him the truth of who he is. And at one point, you know, Billy starts giving mixed messages, and Miguel says, enough, I am out of here. And Billy says, no, don't leave, I don't hate you. And Miguel says, I know you don't. I said, you hate yourself, I'm done, good luck, goodbye. And gives him the opportunity to finally recognize that when he finally sees Miguel a few weeks later, it's like, I've been hungry to get together with you, you know. And finally, you know, why? Because I was too chicken shit to do what I wanted to do last time. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, sorry. Excuse me.
Me.
And what about Little Dragon?
But just to finish with Billy... what it takes for him to leave crime really almost cost him his life, and it's a hell of a choice to be able to gamble that even though I don't feel bright enough, let me err on the side of doing something that gives me my integrity. So he finds, you know, I mean, he comes to his own, and that is very useful. I mean, these are love stories, and that I kind of like. It's like earn the light. They're dark as hell, but they are really love stories that in the end they really heal, and when they heal, there's good. So part two, The Little Dragon, which was the first one written, takes place in Georgia. It takes place in this rural, you know, hellhole prison called Ackmore Juvenile Prison. It's this, it looks like Shawshank Redemption. It's like monstrous, archaic, dark. And he gets transported out to this place and instantly is in one war from hell with a supervisor who recognizes his photos and his boyfriend, which happens to be Billy's twin brother from the wrecking of Billy Barnes. He's with his brother Johnny. And so instantly sets up a war with him and the really homophobic supervisor. And, you know, Ackmore's a hellhole. I worked in juvenile halls before, and we weren't doing treatment. That was crime and punishment. That was like, if you screw up, you know, you're in your room for 24 hours. I mean, there was a place we were not doing what's driving that or what's going on behind that. We were doing no treatment. So, you know, so the Ackmore Juvenile Prison became like the worst part of working in juvenile halls, because there certainly were a number of people who went there just for their power. I mean, the guards who went there, it wasn't about rehab. It was just to keep, you know, it was like two gangs. You had the guards and you had the kids. And so it was really putting Mike into the story where Dostoevsky says allegedly, there's only two stories told. Either a man goes on a journey or a stranger comes to town. And so Billy Barnes was the man goes on the journey, and Little Dragon is Mike Capra, a.k.a. Little Dragon, the stranger who comes to town, the good boy in the nightmarish situation who brings the whole thing down. Because I know what it would take to bring that whole system down. I mean, I've worked in group homes for 35 years. I know those systems. And so in that, it becomes this really useful story. As I read it to a friend of mine who worked in juvenile hall, halfway through, I said, what do you think? And she was like, oh, my God, this is, like, too much. And then when it finished, I said, what do you think? She said, everyone got theirs. You know, the bad guys get theirs and the good guys find their way. And, you know, so it is, as I say, labor of love. And then it leads to the third screenplay, The Dark, Dangerous Homecoming, the last page of Little Dragon. Mike leaves Atlanta with his boyfriend, Billy, Johnny, and they head to San Francisco where Billy is with his boyfriend, Miguel. And it leads to this wild, you know, it's almost the wildest of the three in some way. And it wrote the fastest, and that's what I kind of loved. It's like many times, you know, the first movie is that's the movie, and then the rest are like these franchise knockoffs. This thing wrote faster than the other two parts. It just fell out, and it was The Dark, Dangerous Homecoming, because it came home, but it was all really uncertain. But when it got there, it was like, oh, very cool. You know, you get to really take this great journey. I mean, it's really an emotional journey with these boys, and yet when it heals, it really heals in the best of ways.
Talk a little bit. One of the beauty and the benefits of having live radio is that Gary and I get not only to meet you fabulous authors, but we get to see the passion and the fire in your eyes.
Yeah.
And as you're talking, I mean, you're so animated. You're coming through so strongly. Talk a little bit about characters. You know, these characters are, we know these characters now because of the way you've portrayed them. Talk about creating a character sketch. Do you start out with an idea of who this person is, or does their personality develop as you write the
second
script?
More so, I knew who Mike was in the beginning. He was the clearest because he was me. He was the emotionally bright boy. My boyfriend Doug was the emotionally bright kid. We got it early. You know, we were ostracizing kids at 6 years old, and I just said, wait a second, how would you feel if that was you? I mean, I was that kid. So Mike was that boy. He was this emotionally bright boy, not physically strong boy. So he was clear. Billy came out of nowhere. Billy was always the sidekick character in the book. He didn't have a big part. I mean, he was the side. He was important. But when his screenplay came out, The Reckoning of Billy Barnes, I'd written the first 50 pages like a miniseries, sent it to Eric Bork, who co-wrote Band of Brothers and Earth to the Moon. He'd won like Emmys and Golden Globe winning screenwriter. He read the first 50 pages of Billy Barnes. He said, oh, my God, this movie like a house on fire. I was completely riveted and horrified, not knowing what was going to happen next. And then The Reckoning of Billy Barnes became the gold standard. It took me almost 2 more years to get Little Dragon as good as Billy had gotten. Mm. And I never saw that one coming. You know, mm-hmm. So in there, it's sometimes I sit with something until finally the voice is there. I just am writing the novel of these same kids in an updated version. But in there, there was a scene with this principal, and it took a month to write this 10-page scene. It took 3 weeks to get his voice. And then when I got the principal's voice, then it just, like, really filled in. So I was just kind of waiting for it to come. And there is a place that's almost like waiting for the truth to tell us, if we're lucky. I remember reading Tennessee Williams at one point, and he said, oh, yeah, I was writing a book. He said, this main character, and the main character went around, turned the corner, ran into another character that took over the book. And I just thought that was really funny because I understand that. It's like there were some characters that just, where did they come from? Mm-hmm. It's like I've never known nor had liked drag queens going into the writing of this because the ones I met were kind of catty and kind of that. And, but suddenly in the book, after Mike had gone through hell with this serial killer monster, suddenly out came the drag queens, Monique and Sister Frida Peoples. And she was telling about how she got to be this drag queen. And it was so interesting that when she finished, I understood it better. She said, oh, I was always shy as a boy and always laid back. But as a drag queen, I could take over the dance floor. And it was like, oh, right. So there was the shadow side that was being given an expression that wasn't there. So many times the book kept revealing itself to me. I'll be in the middle of a scene like the one with the principal, and 4 things happened that I didn't see coming because the characters were driving what was going on. Yeah, so the screenplays have that kind of heart to it. The dialogue's always been impeccable. I've been very lucky with that. Is the dialogue is always true. Yeah. That's been the strongest area in this. So their voices just kind of jump off the page. You know, there's such great goodness and there's such great horror all at once. I mean, the nightmarish parts of it are really nightmarish, but the healing is so tender, so sweet, and so, okay, I can go through all of that. I mean, it's my version of Slumdog Millionaire when I look at Billy Barnes. It's like, that's my version of it, you know.
So to help get producers interested in your screenplays, you produced 2 stunning movie trailers. Talk about your decision to market your work in this way and about working with the director of the trailers.
Yeah, that was fun because I didn't know anyone who's ever put together trailers for a screenplay. You know, people do trailers for movies. So we did this with words, images, music. But my friend Ronnie was an Emmy-nominated filmmaker. He just produced these lost JFK tapes for National Geographic and was up for an Emmy. So we figured out, well, I don't know. Well, let's put this together. And the very first piece of music was from The Lord of the Rings. And there was something about the tone of it that hit into, okay, then. And it just led from there. And they became really good because they didn't give away the plot, which sometimes trailers give away the movie. Mm-hmm. But also it was clear about, well, what is this about? Mm-hmm. And so that became, like, really thrilling. And then in the synchronicity of them, Billy Barnes had already won awards. Little Dragon had not. While we're making the trailers, I suddenly get an email from this 1 in 10 gay screenwriting contest that one of the screenplays was a top 12 finalist. It took me another 24 hours to find out it really was Little Dragon, which I was hoping it would be. which meant a lot because they're hardcore thrillers. These things mm-hmm. are scary. They're not for people that are easily disturbed. And yet, when I submitted to the contest, I knew it was done. I didn't know if it was going to win an award, but I knew in my own terms, that's done. That's
complete.
Ready. That's finished. And then the internal matched the external, and that was, you know, that was their judgment, too, is that, you know, it ranked in the top 12 out of 420, which I thought was great because it was a gay and lesbian screenwriting contest, so I was right in genre, you know, rather than the dark horse or mm-hmm. the pink horse, so to speak.
Well, and talk about that from just your own personal ego. What do these recognitions mean to you as a writer, and what kind of feedback did you get from judges?
It meant a lot because I did hundreds of rewrites. You know, there's an endless rewrite process, and I'm totally in love with the rewrite process. And to this day, I adore it because I've never tried to get it perfect. It's always just to get it good enough. So every rewrite is just better and better. Mm. And in that, there's an endless ease to effortless going back into it rather than if I was trying to get it perfect. Each mistake would be frustrating instead. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, that isn't good. Okay. And so in there, there was very little ego involved in it. There really was, because I found Eric Bork, who gives evaluations, you know, I'll spend like $500 and $600 sometimes for an evaluation, and he'll say, look, I want to have you sit with that 4 or 5 days or so before we talk about it. I said, no. I said, I need to talk to you the next day. I will have made those corrections 4 or 5 days ago. If the scene didn't work, then what would work better rather than, oh, it did too, and he just doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. So there was an ease inside of me. If it didn't work, if somebody didn't get it, I just wasn't clear enough. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with, oh, they just weren't missing, you know, whatever it was. There was someplace. So in that, it became this absolute fearlessness to go back and tell it and tell it and tell it, because it was a story to me worth telling. And, you know, there's this guy, Robert McKee, who wrote a book called The Story. And in there, I have it, you know, on my computer. There's a little paragraph. It says something like, the author's only two gifts are perseverance and passion. And, you know, are you willing to get up each day and at times ignore the rest of your life to do this? Is this a project that means so much to you that you'll be inspired to go at it and add it to the ultimate goal of, you know, a perfection, which is impossible? And he said, in the end, because why give your life to something not worth your life? Mm-hmm. This is worth my life. Mm. This is, it's a story that, yeah, that gets told inside out from the best of reasons. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's worth it all, so.
So you're,
I have a little bit of passion about it. I've been trying to develop some enthusiasm as I go over the years.
That's great. We don't have a whole lot of time left, Jeff. We'll have to have you back. Talk about your day job.
Day job. I'm a trainer with the National Foster Parent Association, work with group home staff, social workers, MFTs, therapists. And just on how to stay renewed while doing this, how to take care of someone else and simultaneously take care of ourselves. You know, so it's always been a balance is how I learned how to do all of this. You know, so many of the trainings are about my relationship with Doug, you know, my 30-year, you know, partner 30 years. He's who I worked it out with, you know. I mean, one of the big arts is how to have a battle and be connected, you know. And so a lot of it is
still
life skills about
how
to take care of yourself while taking care of others, how to speak from inside rather than about other people. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it is just good life skills of how to get by on the planet in a kinder way, mm-hmm. kind of in a more gentler way, but how to get by with your integrity and to finally claim ourselves as the only gift that we have to give any other human being.
Right, right.
If I know myself, then I'm interested in knowing you, and then we could have a relationship because mm-hmm. here I am, who are you, rather than who are you and what's going on, tell me about yourself, and
you,
I'm not here to deal with me, I came for you. It's like, what's that? Yeah, so it's relational trainings. They really are.
Great.
The relationship is huge.
Great. Well, we wish you the best of luck, Jeff.
It's
been
a pleasure.
Please come back. Please come back.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Well, I definitely will. I would love to come back.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Good. We do want to thank Scott O'Brien also, who is out there still. Scott, thank you for joining us tonight, for sharing your new biography. And to our listeners, you can listen to this and all Outbeat Radio shows at outbeatradio.com. Do want to thank you for your continual support. Hope that you'll listen every Sunday evening at 8 p.m. And then please support KRCB Radio and enjoy its new musical format. This is a very exciting time for KRCB, for all the changes that are happening. Next week, Greg Moralia will be here with Outbeat News In Depth.
Gary, Mary, and I will return Sunday, December 15th with Kevin Jones from the Sonoma County Stonewall Democrats. We'll talk about the state of LGBT politics here as we round out the year 2013. A very early happy Thanksgiving to everyone from all of us here at Outbeat Collage. We are thankful for your listenership, your friendship, and have a great and wonderful week.